This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week we come to you from Newark, New Jersey, in particular, Newark Liberty International Airport. Why are we here? The launch this week of the first commercially scheduled service from Newark to Havana on United Airlines, one of a number of airlines now flying regularly scheduled service from the United States to Cuba, and more to come. We're taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. And, of course, you can always reach me on Twitter. My handle is at Peter S. Greenberg, or Facebook.com/Peter Greenberg. So much to talk about in the news, in the post-election madness of what will be affected in travel and tourism, since this is about travel, and what won't. President-elect Trump rumbling that he might consider rolling back all the progress made in the relationship between the United States and Cuba in terms of travel and tourism, especially, and airline flying rights between the two countries. That remains to be seen if that's going to happen, but he's opened the door to at least talk about it and basically saying everything's back on the table. But if you're the CEO of Hilton or Marriott / Starwood or Hyatt or Wyndham or any one of a number of international hotels like Intercontinental, that statement has to have you at least worried, because you thought you had the green light to begin serious investment work in Cuba. Banks, of course, got permission to remove the blocks. You know, merchant terminals are now in place and being installed throughout the country of Cuba to allow them to swipe credit cards. Remember, as of a year and a half ago, a U.S.-based credit card wouldn't even work in Cuba. So, another thing to think about. What does this mean to you as travelers? Here you have a situation where just about every U.S. airline is flying from at least one interesting city in the U.S. down to at least one interesting city in Cuba, not necessarily always Havana. That door is open. You have a cruise ship, Fathom, which is going there now, and rest of Carnival will probably be there within the next 12 to 16 to 18 months, along with the other major carriers like Royal Caribbean and Celebrity and Norwegian. So that door is open. Have the horses left the barn? Can you put the genie back in the bottle? My argument would be you probably can't, because the economics are so strong now, it doesn't benefit anyone. You know, we can look at all the numbers, and it doesn't have to be a case history of Cuba, to realize that travel provides jobs, one of the strongest economic bases that's sustainable. In many cases, is over 10% of GDP in some countries. It's about 10% globally in terms of GDP. And Cuba is just the most recent example of a country that was considered off limits to the United States for decades and now isn't. And now, having said all that, I strongly believe that it's not a question of if you're going to go. It's really a question of when you're going to go and then how you're going to go. And when you're going to go may determine how you're going to go. Up until recently, you could only do charter flights. Now you have regularly scheduled air service. You can go in by cruise ship, and pretty soon, even the bigger cruise ships will be going down. All right, but when are you going to go? And I think that's an important consideration right now. If you want to truly immerse yourself in the Cuban culture, in the Cuban experience, not just in Havana, but in so many cities outside and throughout the country, if you want to enjoy the music, the food, the history, the rum, the cigars. Oh, yeah, did I mention cigars? When's the best time to go? Probably last week. And it's because of infrastructure issues. There are not enough hotel rooms in Cuba to handle the hordes that are going to be wanting to go and that are starting to come. There are only about 60,000 available hotel rooms in the whole country. So you really can't, you know, rush into it because there may be no place for you to stay. However, over 8,000 Airbnb listings now throughout the country of Cuba. That never was the case. So the whole idea is, do you want to go before Kentucky Fried Chicken gets there? With all due respect to Kentucky Fried Chicken, nothing against them, but that doesn't mean Cuba to me. I strongly suggest that you take a five-letter word out of your vocabulary, that word being later, and replace it with a three-letter word meaning now, and see it while there's still Cuba in Cuba. Remember, you know, for a country that's only 90 miles off the coast of the United States, it's amazing they've been able to retain their culture and heritage as long as they have. Now, they've been bootlegging MTV and CNN and American hit television shows. They know more about, you know, Two Broke Girls than the Two Broke Girls know. So that part's inevitable. But, you know, you go outside of Havana into the countryside and to more rural areas of Cuba, it's the way it was in 1958 when Castro was in the middle of his revolution. So especially now, considering that Fidel has passed away at the ripe old age of 90, this guy probably holds the record as the Teflon dictator, because how many times did the United States try to assassinate him, kill him, poison his food, spike his drink, put pills in him? And he outlasted them all, and he outlived most of them. As a fierce nationalist and someone who is either revered or reviled, there's no middle ground. But whereas there's absolutely no middle ground, in fact, there's no two sides of the story, is this: whether you're pro-Castro or anti-Castro, pro-Cuba or anti-Cuba, you want to go. And the time to go, it's not negotiable, boys and girls. The time to go is now. By the way, on this inaugural United Airlines flight, they kicked off airfares. $200 round trip from Newark. Why couldn't you go at that? Right? Now, will they stay at $200? Not for long. But guess what? We're coming up into, you know, there's always that dead week right after New Year's. Right? There are two dead weeks. The one we're in right now, the week after Thanksgiving, and the one right after New Year's. And maybe a good opportunity to fly somewhere, could be Cuba, where the airfares are inexpensive. In fact, in the next hour of the show, I'm going to talk about some bizarre airfare situations caused as a direct result of the American presidential election.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Talking with David Hilton, who runs all worldwide sales for I almost said Continental. I almost said it because that's how we know each other.
Yeah, we started.
I know, we did. But of course, now it's United Airlines in the merged state of Continental and United. David, Cuba as an issue has always been incendiary. You're either pro or you're con. You're either pro-Castro or anti-Castro. Here's a situation where you're launching service. I mean, not because it was planned this way, but ironically, just a few days after the death of Fidel Castro at the age of 90. And as much anti-Castro sentiment as is erupting now, which has always been there, or pro-Castro sentiment, is it really going to stop people from wanting to go to Cuba?
Well, great question. And yeah, all back to the Condal days. Been great ever since the merger in 2010 and making all kinds of progress. Well, I want you to know on that question, Yeah, I think we respect and appreciate everyone's opinion. There's a lot of them in this case, and we understand very sensitive. Candidly, people, they want to explore, and they want to, I think they want to gain a better understanding of all that's going on in Havana. And whatever the reason, we want to fulfill our mission and be the great air carrier. And if you want to go, great. And if you don't, we understand that. And but demand seems to be very high.
You know, I remember, I'm old enough to remember, Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then, of course, the Trading with the Enemies Act, and all those years of the embargo. There wasn't a U.S. president, if you read the historical biographies correctly, and I do, and I interpret them correctly, there wasn't a U.S. president that didn't want to recognize Cuba and the Castro regime, but they never want to recognize them in the first term because they were worried about losing the Florida vote. And that was Kennedy, of course, who, by the way, the little-known story about Kennedy is that on November 22nd, 1963, the very day he was assassinated in Dallas, he had a secret emissary sitting with Fidel Castro to negotiate the terms of reconciliation and recognition. And while they were about to make the deal, an aide walks into Castro's office and hands him a piece of paper that tells him that Kennedy's been shot and killed in Dallas. And it was Castro who told the American emissary, your president's just been shot, and this deal is never going to happen because LBJ will never approve it. And he was right. And it was LBJ, it was then Nixon, it was then Ford, it was then Carter, it was then Reagan, and then it was Clinton. It was Bush, and then it was Clinton. And the interesting thing about Clinton was Clinton wanted to recognize Cuba at the end of his second term, and the deal was basically pre-negotiated. It was in place, ready to go. And it was going to be done by Al Gore. He was going to sneak down there when nobody was looking, and then there'll be the handshake and the deal done. And like the day before it was going to happen, this little kid washes up in Miami called Ilian Gonzalez, and all bets were off, and the whole thing just blew up. So it's taken another 14 years for this to actually finally happen.
Yeah, pretty extraordinary history it is. And again, we understand there's all kinds of views, amazing historical references that you've talked about, and Now that the relations have been legitimized, we're excited about the chance that out of Newark, we're going to take all these people. Customers are ready to go, and so are employees. You know, we have a lot of our employees of Cuban descent who are they're excited about this opportunity, and they're making their way.
Bottom line is, you know, your world lives or dies based on demand and yield. The initial fares down to Cuba, I understand, are relatively low. Your introductory fares are, what, $200?
Yeah, we'd love to see them a little higher.
Yeah, no kidding.
You never met an airline guy who said he didn't, you know, meet a higher fare he didn't like.
Right. But you have an introductory fare.
We do. Very, very good. And you're right. I mean, there's significant new capacity in the market. We have a lot of good competitors. And fact is, we're all vying to get more people.
Well, you got JetBlue going out of Kennedy.
Yep.
You got you going out of here. You got Delta. You got American. You have Alaska Airlines. I mean,
there's a lot of seats in the market, so a lot of opportunity for people to take advantage of some great pricing.
Of course, there are not a lot of hotel rooms in the market, and that's the problem with infrastructure once you get to Cuba, which is why there's like 8,000 Airbnb listings right now.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Well, I'm sure if you're a developer, you're finding ways to lock into some new building down there.
Well, interestingly enough, David, the issue is not that. The issue is long outstanding claims against the Cuban government by companies like Hilton, which saw their properties appropriated by the Castro regime, and you have real title issues here. So what's going to happen is they're never going to be able to determine title. Those days are over. So what the Cuban government's probably going to do is find new pieces of land for them on a lease deal or a partnership deal to start building, but that's still going to take 3 years. So you're not going to see new hotel rooms suddenly open up. They're not there yet. So, you know, when you think about what an airline does, it's more than just, and please feel free to disagree with me, but it's more than just selling a seat and flying from point A to point B. It's the infrastructure once you get there. It's tour packages. It's frequent flyer programs. It's people wanting to redeem their miles in a place they want to go, right?
Absolutely.
And now you can do that with your United Airlines. You can redeem frequent flyer miles to go to Cuba.
Absolutely. And United Airlines Vacations. These guys have been on kind of the fronting end. It's handled for us by a company called Mark Travel, but it's United Airlines Vacations. And they were really on the forefront working with a number of the ground operators in Havana. So we're excited about it. But you're right. It is a very complex business. I mean, the primary issue is safe and affordable travel from point A to B. And from there, though, there is a lot to it.
So what do you see coming down the road? Right now, you're operating a 7-3 on the route. Are you restricted on the kind of aircraft you can operate?
We're not. But, again, as you pointed out, it's all about demand. So as we always evaluate and monitor how bookings are and how we're performing on the route, we're always willing to change the gauge of the aircraft up or down, depending on demand. And right now, we think it's a great airplane, the Boeing 737-800, and flying similar equipment out of Houston. And we'll just watch it and see how it does. Hopefully, we'll need to add bigger airplane over time.
What's your biggest challenge right now?
Oh, I think, our biggest challenge is just knowing that, there's a lot of good competition. We want to make sure we're getting the message out about how much progress we've made at United, whether it's the great on-time performance or materially improved customer satisfaction. Plus,
Are you giving me a sales pitch?
I am. But, the one thing you and I talked about is we're coming out with a huge new Polaris product, and that's a big deal for us, and it's a major investment. So getting out to make sure everybody knows about that, that's a big challenge on the sales side, and people are going to love it.
And then there's on-time performance.
On-time performance is absolutely critical. And, we've seen our best on-time performance in the history of the airline since actually our merger back in 2010. So if we haven't seen folks on United lately, there's my commercial pitch. I think you ought to come and join us, Joe. You'll be delighted.
I knew it was coming. There it was. Once a sales guy, always a sales guy. I knew it.
Love you.
Are there routes right now that you're looking at that make any sense anymore? And I'll tell you why. In the world of strategic alliances and, all, as you mentioned, so much competition, it's tough to start a new route that hasn't been done already. I mean, or that already isn't saturated. Because we're living in a world now, at least with U.S. airlines, where, to use an expression, you're practicing capacity discipline and you're shrinking back capacity in domestic routes.
Well, great question. And I would tell you, Peter, we've got great data. Very sophisticated analysis that goes on. Get the input from our salespeople. We're certainly talking to our business partners, travel agents, corporations. So whoever the routes that we're evaluating opportunities, there's an enormous amount of analysis and review that goes into it before we launch. Not everything is risk-free. In fact, most of the time when you're investing aircraft, which can vary anywhere from $100 million to $300 million, and that's before you even talk about expenses at the airport and our labor costs, I mean, it's a big deal, but we feel really good based on really how much I think the work in our scheduling, network, and planning departments have done in collaboration with government affairs, sales, marketing, research. And, we can't fly anymore just because we think it's great to grow and we want to fly. We do it because
for the sake of growth.
Yeah, we got to grow. We need to grow profitably, need to do the right thing by our customers and shareholders. And I think United have done a really good job of that over the last few years. Frankly, I think the industry has done a better job of that. Certainly the U.S.
Because there was a time when you guys were all in competition to see either who could lose money longer, right? I mean, seriously.
Well, it was a lot of that. It was probably the, what would they often talk about? A very testosterone-type business where you had people that wanted to, they wanted to get big and you wanted to see all this just grow for the sake of market share. And the fact
But it's not about market share anymore.
No, it isn't.
It's about yield.
It's about profitability and flying where strategically in your network you think long-term it's going to be good for everybody involved. And then you're going to stay in the markets.
Yeah, you can't just go in and then it doesn't work for a day and you leave.
Yeah, you got to be there long-term.
You got to stay.
Yeah, absolutely. People are looking for reliability. They want consistency, and that's what we're all about at United. I know other carriers will tell you that, and they should. I mean, that's how you win customers long-term.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care. I am a passenger.
We're talking Cuba, the launch of a number of airlines flights nonstop from the U.S. to Havana and other cities throughout the country of Cuba. And the question then becomes, what about the guys who've been offering these tours and selling Cuba, if you will, to Americans and other travelers for years? What's the impact of this? What does it mean, especially now in terms of the recent passing of Fidel Castro? Joining me now is Greg Geronimus, who's the co-CEO of Smart Tours. You guys have been doing Cuba tours for years.
For several years now, and we're excited by the development of commercial air. That only helps us bring down the price.
Because before that, you were chartering.
Yes, the charter air was
quite
expensive.
And charter was very expensive.
Yeah, much more expensive. So we're going to shave off a much-needed few hundred dollars off the price of a trip to Cuba, which will help combat combat the ever-escalating increases in the hotel prices.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that, because you got infrastructure problems down there. You only have about 60,000 available hotel rooms. They're already full of Canadians and Europeans who have been going there for 5 decades.
There's a major capacity problem, and there was even before Obama's historic announcement in December 2014, and it's only become exacerbated since then. And it's not just in Havana. It's all throughout the island, further east into Cienfuegos, into Trinidad.
Veradero.
Veradero is a little bit better because they've got these massive resorts for the
Canadians. But the Jamaicans came in and
exactly
they built them. The packages that you were offering before, they still were under the 12 available approved designations, if you will, who could go there.
Sure. It's by no means was it tourism or leisure travel. It was people to people.
Not a lot of pool time.
That's right. Just a little bit, perhaps in the evenings after you get your full schedule of people to people activities and exchanges, and you really do get to know the Cuban people. It is a great way to travel, and it has been for several years.
But I would suspect now, I mean, you have a company called Smart Tours, but everybody's jumping on the bandwagon to be in there and develop it.
They are. The problem is getting hotel space. Tour companies like ourselves, like Smart Tours.
You have blocked rooms.
We have blocked rooms, and we have relationships, so that definitely helps.
What are the challenges now? Because everybody wants to be first on their block. Whether they're flying in or sailing in. But if they're sailing in, that's not really an issue because they don't need rooms. They're staying on the ship and they're leaving. But for those who are flying in, what other than rooms, what are the challenges? I would think that the Cubans can't ramp up their cigar production. I think that they can't ramp up their rum production. I think they can't ramp. Nobody cares about their sugar production because the market's so low. But for the things that people are coming to expect when they get there.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And it depends on how you're arriving to Cuba. If you're going on your own, there are a whole host of challenges in terms of being able to actually execute on, say, a people-to-people exchange or...
Although the way they've defined people-to-people these days, I've said it earlier in the show, if you talk to a bartender, you've had one.
That's true. But there are a lot of people who want to really make sure that they're doing the trip by the book. And it depends on, you know, how careful the traveler is. But you're absolutely right to your previous point about the challenges that we face. Everything is backed up. It's not just the hotel space. Nevertheless, we're still hearing...
Okay, let's talk about what's backed up. You talk about transportation, ground transportation?
Absolutely. It's very hard to get one of those precious vintage American cars.
Everybody wants one.
Yeah. Not only are they jacking up the price, but they're becoming more and more scarce relative to the
number of
travelers.
You see, I have a suspicion that when the door really opens up, the Cubans are going to come to America and buy a lot of used cars.
I think that's a great point.
Right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Because that's what people are expecting when they go there.
Yeah, sure.
All right, so but I'm not just talking about the antique cars. I'm talking about just basic mass transportation issues.
It was strained to begin with. The infrastructure was underdeveloped, and now you have the sea of Americans on top of the Europeans, on top of the Canadians, and it's a real challenge.
I know that the blocks were lifted on terminals for credit cards, that people are now installing them, so you can swipe a U.S.-based credit card, which you could not have done a year and a half ago.
That's correct.
I get that. But there's still not enough terminals around.
We recommend that people still follow the practice of bringing as much cash as they need.
Dollars or euros?
Dollars.
Even with the premium that they're charging?
Even with the premium, because you negate some of the benefit by doing the double exchange. So if you're exchanging from dollars to euros and then euros to...
Back to dollars.
Back to the Cuban, the convertible peso, and then...
The CUC.
And the CUC, and then back into dollars, you're getting hit a couple times. So... We actually used to advise that to our clients, and after some feedback that was not so kind, we've gone back to recommending dollars.
Well, all the times I've been to Cuba, I have yet to see a real ATM machine.
Oh, neither have I.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. Doing these kinds of agreements between countries is usually difficult with any country. It's historic when it comes to a country like Cuba, which hasn't seen scheduled U.S. airline service in decades. Joining me now, the head of all regulatory affairs for United Airlines, Steve Morrissey. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, Peter.
I'm one of those airline geeks that looks at the OAG and looks at schedules and tries to figure out how did this airline get a chance to fly between these two non-affiliated countries and all that kind of stuff. Here, we were dealing with rights between the U.S. and Cuba, many of which well, most of which had been dormant for 50 years.
That's right.
It's my understanding that the U.S. Department of Transportation essentially deemed them no longer dormant but dead, and you had to start from scratch.
That's been their precedent. When they look at rights that haven't been able to use for a long time, for whatever reason, whether it's carriers or government restrictions, they've always taken the position that, you know, they'll assess the market when rights become available rather than just hold them in dormancy.
I mean, in a given year, you're not just dealing with Cuba. You're dealing with every agreement that you have with how many different countries is United flying to now?
Oh, the current number, I think, is 58 as of today.
Right, and every one of them wants to be number one on your list or doesn't, right, depending on how we're doing, right?
That's right.
And every country wants, in some way or another, is protectionist. They want to protect their carrier or their flying rights. At the end of the day, it's about revenue and who gets to keep it, right? I remember, I'll tell you a story. In the old days of Braniff, they were flying from Buenos Aires up to Los Angeles and from Rio to Los Angeles. They were in trouble because the authorities there wouldn't let them take out their profits in dollars. And yet they're operating the plane. So they came up with the most unique way to make money. What they did was, what's Argentina known for? Leather. So they went into the leather airline seat business. And they scheduled their planes to fly to Buenos Aires and do a 16-hour overnight, during which time they took out all the fabric seats, put in the leather seats that they had made there, flew the plane back with leather seats, and then sold the seats, right? So they were making money literally not by selling seats to me. They were literally selling the actual airline seat to other airlines. So that's how they got around those regulations. But I'm sure you have those kinds of challenges all the time because there are certain countries right now like Venezuela, nobody wants to fly there because A, they don't pay their bills, and B, you can't get your money out.
It's part of what makes international aviation so exciting. Every day is a different day. There are challenges around the world, but a company like United, we've got a long experience. We've got people who have dealt with things like this, like opening a station like Havana.
Well,
many
then
let's
talk about that. What were your biggest challenges? Because first of all, you weren't alone. Every airline and their mother wanted to fly down there because everybody wanted to be first on their block, no doubt about it. They all wanted to fly to Havana. The Cubans were also saying, well, maybe not just Havana, but seven or eight other airports right. as well. So it wasn't like, hey, we'd like to come, let's sign the deal. It was a little bit more complicated than that.
Correct. This one definitely was unique. I mentioned we have a team that does this, a startup team. They're some of the best in the business. They've started up new services at points around the globe with challenges that you can't even conceive.
Give me what your craziest challenge that you can talk about. Not about Cuba, just in general.
Well, I mean, we're typically going into places that aren't as well developed commercially as we're used to. So it's, I mean, there's a checklist of hundreds of things that have to happen for a flight to happen. Everything from the catering, the customs, the security, the
communications,
the provisioning, the crews and how they're able to enter and exit the country.
Even the type of tickets you can write.
That's what part of what makes Havana or Cuba so unique. I think the challenges we faced here that might be a little bit unique. One was the time frame. You know, normally there's more time for startup. This was a very compressed case from the point at which DOT granted rights to the point at which we need to start up.
So this was
90 days.
This was like hurry up and wait, and then you better hurry up again.
That's right. That's right. There was a 90-day startup condition, and all of the carriers that got rights to fly are starting generally within 92 to 120 days
right.
of startup. On top of that, Cuba's unique in that there are still travel restrictions. So there are IT issues, technology issues, processing issues that needed to be worked out on a very expedited basis.
Foreign exchange issues.
Foreign exchange issues, for sure. That's always a big deal.
I mean, somebody wants to pay cash for a ticket. It's like, wait a minute.
Right. And you know, so our teams have worked through all those things. They applied the benefit of their experience to this unique situation. And, you know, everything is going to be just fine. I think the thing that we never lost sight of is this is exciting. When do we ever get to serve a new point on the map that 2 years ago we didn't think we could? And I think the sort of outpouring of support for these flights was part of that sense of opportunity.
Now, in the old days, and by the way, I qualify that as like last week, right? But in the old days, you know, if you wanted to fly, and tell me if I'm wrong, but if you wanted to fly a 737 down there, then the United States would say to the Cuban airline or the other airline, another whatever country it would be, you can fly a 737 here. It was basically parity of seats, parity of flights, right?
That's right.
Is that still the case?
This one's a little bit different. I don't want to get into the technicalities of, you know, bilateral international aviation, but
that's like reading my insurance policy.
this is technically not a formal open skies or bilateral agreement. It's essentially an understanding to operate on comity and reciprocity.
Yeah, because if you were doing open skies, that would presume that the Cuban airline had the equipment and the planes to be open skies, which they don't.
That's right. That's right. And there are still issues with the embargo in place and potential for asset seizures and that kind of thing that make this a little bit more complicated.
Okay, I have to ask the question. If I'm Cuban and I'm living in Havana and I fly on United Airlines, can I join the frequent flyer program?
Yes, you can. That was one of the more complicated things that we needed to work out.
But they wanted it, didn't they?
They sure do. And
see, that's the power of the frequent flyer program.
That's right.
Forget 50 years of embargo. The first thing they want, we want mileage.
That's right. And you know, of course, I'm biased, but we have the best mileage program.
Oh, stop
in the business,
it, Steve. So. Stop it right now. But the bottom line, even that gets negotiated.
That's right. It does. You know, again, something that makes Cuba a little bit unique is all of the body of regulations that don't have anything really to do with aviation that also come into play here. Things like foreign asset control and that.
And who can fly there?
Who can fly there? The 12 categories. You know, it's not just open and free for anybody who wants to go.
Right. But you and I both know, wink, wink, those 12 categories are changing by the hour.
We follow the rules as they're
written. Mr. Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca. Yeah, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, those definitions are changing.
This is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure.
Interesting passenger compliment on this plane today, because, you know, most inaugural flights have dignitaries, officials, airport executives, airline executives, guys like me. But for some passengers on this plane, it's a rather emotional journey because it represents their first time back to that island nation in many, many years. And that applies to even some of the airline employees, like Izel Garcia. Izel, you are a coordinator here at Newark Airport for United. But more importantly than that, you're going home.
Yes. Yes, after 46 long years.
I mean, tell me the story. When did you leave? Why did you leave? And
we left for political reasons. My parents did not agree with the government. You know, when Fidel took over, they took over all our properties and all that. My dad had to work for the fields for the government as punishment, sort of, say, to be able to leave the country. After 2 years, we were a number, and our number came up, and we left the country, eight of us. My parents, my brother, myself, two aunts, and a grandmother and a cousin.
Wow. What year was that?
May 15th, 1970.
Wow. So that wasn't the first exodus. It was like the second or third exodus.
That's because, correct.
Right?
And one of the last ones, I think.
Right. And then after that, it was just the Mariel boat lift. And
that is correct.
Exactly.
Yes.
So what does this trip mean to you?
Oh, my gosh. I haven't been able to sleep since they invited me a week ago. Very emotional, you know. And for me, yes, it's going home. But also, this is home. I mean, I love being an American citizen, forever grateful for what this country has given me. But it's going back to my roots, and it's able to set foot on land that gave me my life, and being so suppressed, and it was taboo, you know, to go there. None of my family members have ever returned. So it's...
You're the first one?
I'm the first one.
Wow.
The first one. And I have a long family. I have 13 uncles, you know, aunts and uncles.
And they're waiting to see you.
And they're waiting. They're here. I have...
Oh, yeah. Anybody back there?
Yes. I have an aunt and multiple cousins that are waiting to see me. They won't see me on this trip, but it'll be a quick trip, but it'll be nice for me to set foot.
But this
there.
Is sort of opening the door.
Yes, 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 yes.
What about the ironic thing about this flight, which has been planned for quite some time, is it's happening just a few days after the death of Fidel Castro?
You know, for me, it's actually sweeter. And I don't mean that in a morbid way, that I'm not happy that somebody died. But for me, it's better to know that person who's created so much anger and so much horrific things to my family, too. I'm sorry, but I'm glad that he's not there anymore.
You know, it's interesting, you know, because we live in, well, for lack of a better term, divided times. We've just had an election that represents a divided country in this country. Depending on who you talk to, there are people who are Fidel loyalists, and there are people who will never, ever be happy about him. And a lot of deep-seated either support or deep-seated anger.
I agree. And honestly, I think the supporters are mostly the generation, like my generation, that never left the country, and they don't know any better. All they know is communism, and they saw him as a, you know, he's fair to everybody. Fair mean in extreme poverty and no human rights, but they don't know any better. They don't know any better. You know, that's what I think. But yet, people are very, very divided. Very divided.
Now, the door has been open. There are 8 U.S. airlines that are flying there now, or will be flying there, not just to Havana, but to many other airports in Cuba. From an airline perspective, and I'll be asking this to some of your executives as well, but from an airline perspective, this represents United's first time back in Cuba since when?
Oh my gosh, I think 1950 or something like that. And for me, being an airline employee for this airline that I love my company, it means the world. I'm so proud, and I hope it brings us good business, and I know it will, and I know it will. And hooray for them for getting the bid to leave, you know, to fly out of Newark. It's phenomenal. And hopefully it'll be really, really good business for them.
I have to ask this question. Will you be drinking a mojito on board?
Of course.
Will they be serving mojitos on board?
I hope so. Usually on inaugural flights, they try to make it as more, you know, homely as they can. So I'm hoping that'll be fun.
And you'll do one flight a day? Is that what United Airlines
does? Yes, yes. We're starting with one flight a day.
On a 737?
Mm-hmm.
And this flight that you're on today as an inaugural flight, it's really just a quick turn. You're flying down.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the ground for about an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Get back on the plane, right? Take a few pictures.
Yes.
It's selfie time.
Oh, my God, a few. Take many pictures.
Right. Selfie, and then right back.
Yeah. And that's okay. You know, that's okay with me. Actually, personally, it's better than okay because the embargo hasn't been lifted. So. But to me, it's putting my feet in land, in my
land. But you know what, though? The embargo more or less has been lifted.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's sort of like the Claude Rains character in Casablanca, shocked to finding out that gambling is going on in Rick's casino, but collecting his winnings from the night before, because anybody right now, based on even the most narrow definition of people-to-people programs, can buy a ticket and go down.
That's correct. Yeah, that is correct. Yeah.
Because in the old days, you know, it was that you had to have a very specialized itinerary.
Mm-hmm.
Every minute was spoken for. You weren't allowed to go to the beach and hang out. It was more like you were going to meet the people in a cultural exchange. Today, based on the Obama administration's definition of the rules, a cultural exchange is talking to your bartender.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, Roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Now I radio clearance, over.
That's Clarence, over. Over.
Roger.
Huh?
This week, the launch of nonstop service. JetBlue started from Kennedy. United started from Newark, and other airlines are flying as well. The doors are not just creaking open, they're slamming open, and we haven't even dealt with cruises yet. Joining me now, the Deputy Digital Director of Condé Nast Traveler, Laura Redmond. How are you, Laura?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Okay, so from your perspective, what are you seeing at the magazine in terms of reader interest? It must be a frenzy.
I would definitely say frenzy. I mean,
frenzy for Cuba.
We've been talking about Cuba since, I've been thinking about Cuba for over a year. I went for the first time in February, and I'm hoping to get back next year. But our readers want the latest, and it keeps changing,
well,
so we
readers,
have to keep updating.
If I know your readers well, they want to be the first on their block, and they want bragging rights.
Yeah, that's fair.
Is that fair enough?
Well, who doesn't, right? Yeah. I mean, everyone wants
to
get there.
Although, knowing Condé Nast Traveler, they're looking for a more authentic trip, plus they would like a spa.
A spot to that feels like something they won't get elsewhere. They don't want to be at a standard hotel, a hotel that feels like it could be in any city.
They don't want a cookie cutter.
No, not at
all. You're not going to find cookie cutter hotels in Havana. They don't exist.
No, although it's interesting. The Casa Particulares are becoming more and more popular.
Well, the Casa Particulares are interesting because there are over 8,000 Airbnb listings in Cuba as well.
Right. It's their fastest growing market right now.
Yeah. The Cuban people are becoming free traders in travel and tourism.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's it. And that's their largest export to begin with. It's not rum, it's not cigars, it's certainly not sugar. It's travel and tourism.
Absolutely. And, you know, as Americans try to get there before McDonald's gets there, that's the refrain
that
I keep hearing.
By the way,
yeah.
I've been saying that throughout the show. I've been saying, my statement is BKFC, before Kentucky Fried Chicken. And they're coming. You know they're coming.
They're coming. Now they're coming by commercial plane, as you said. They had been going by chartered plane and through people-to-people excursions through companies like Insight Cuba or individual groups that they had been booking. But I went on a people-to-people tour with Inside Cuba, and it was fantastic. You still have to follow under.
We did a trip with them for CBS News. I went down there about 4 years ago on that, yeah.
Where'd you go?
It was Havana. But, you know, what people need to know about those tours back then is that your schedule was pretty rigid. You not a lot of beach time, no pool time, you know, an occasional, you know, maybe a sneak, you know, a little sneaky mosquito, but or a mojito, I should say.
There are some sneaky mosquitoes there too.
But under the rules, you really did it that way. Now those rules have changed dramatically.
In the last few months, I'd say. When I went, it was still very much a cultural excursion, 9 to 5. You had to be booked. You were booked.
You had to count for your time.
Absolutely. And now that you can take these commercial flights, you basically just have to click a box on JetBlue or
United
Site.
And say you had people to experience with your bartender.
Yeah, well, kind of. I mean, if the U.S. government decides they want to check on your trip, you know.
They've never done it.
Not yet.
No. Well.
Hey, I'm on the record, right? So
you're on the record, yeah. Okay.
But there are the 12 categories of travel that you can fall under have broadened a bit. So you can go just to support the Cuban people. You can go for an event, an athletic or a cultural event.
I know friends of mine who went there to support their need to drink.
Right. Well, do you have a lot of, like, your callers, are they saying, I'm just going to try to have a tourist vacation? Because
well,
that's still off
enough,
the
grid. A lot of my audience were going to Cuba as solo renegade travelers, you know, going through other countries like Canada or Mexico or the Cayman Islands or Jamaica. For the last 20 years, the Cubans never stamped their passports. They officially weren't there. And they had a great time. And the United States government, and I've said this throughout the show, I mean, the U.S. government certainly was aware of it. They knew about it. And I think they made a conscious decision not to prosecute anybody, because to do so would be to admit how many people were actually doing it.
Right. Absolutely. And I think more and more people are going to go. The cruises, like you mentioned before, cruises are interesting because Carnival's Fathom Line had been doing these tourism trips.
Right.
That they only recently just decided to end.
Scaled back.
Right.
Especially in the Dominican Republic.
Right.
And the reason for that, and I think it was a sort of a sad awakening for them, because they were trying to combine, and I salute them for this, they were trying to combine a cruise experience with a volunteer vacation. And I think what they found is that, at least in the case of the Dominican Republic, and by the way, their passenger reviews were stupendous. I mean, the people who actually went and had the experience had a really great time, but there weren't enough of them.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.